Okay, this is side two, the second part of session number 23, done on December 11th, 2006. And we're into the William Irwin Thompson part of my book, which is on the right-hand side page, following from McLuhan on the right-hand side page. And we were reading from a Thompson book called Evil in World Order, came out in 1977. And I'll continue where I left off in that quote. He says, in industrial society, you are what you own. In contemplative cultures, your being is the source of your identity. Contemplatives need less, consume less, and therefore can produce less. No man need labor 8 hours a day at the same dreary task of putting a door on a Cadillac. In industrial culture, poverty is a disgrace. In contemplative culture, that means today, he meant in the 70s, in contemplative digital culture, poverty is the elegance of simplicity. As long as we continue to live in industrial culture, we will need an authoritarian government to control unemployment, create jobs, subsidize the auto industry, and strip mine the Dakotas so that America can become one continental Los Angeles. If we have a spiritual transformation, there's the key, if we have a spiritual transformation, not more nuclear plants, as Lewis would say, if we have a spiritual transformation and create a meta-industrial culture, that means the industrial culture would shrink and be inside nature. If we have this spiritual transformation and create a meta-industrial culture, the drastic solutions of mass government will be unnecessary. And I would add that McLuhan generally talks about analog, what's called analog media, right, as opposed to digital media.
Mm-hmm.
You follow that? Mm-hmm. So Thompson is moving into the effects of the digital, even though McLuhan lives in the 70s and comments on the digital media. But in the quotes we've used, it's generally McLuhan commenting about the apotheosis of the analog media in the global theater of the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And the beginning of, definitely McLuhan intuits the Android meme, which is the digital phase. But here we have Thompson. He's not using the word digital, but he's dealing with the shrinking of the analog media. Okay?
Right. Well, the Android meme starts to develop in, like, 1960, right?
Yeah. But that's when the digital world really gets going in MIT.
So, and you're saying McLuhan is partially oblivious?
No. Well, no. The quotes we're using are more about the analog media phase.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't get talking about digital. We don't have quotes on digital media per se until the late 70s, just before he dies, and he predicts the internet, and he's right on top of it.
Yeah.
But his book From Cliché to Archetype is describing the Android meme, and so he actually bypasses the digital and gets right into the Android meme.
Whereas the Android meme was the digital,
right? But let's say he gets into studying the effects of the Android meme. Thompson here is celebrating the effects of the digital.
Mm-hmm.
He's seeing the great services that will happen, the shrinking of the analog industrial and media structure. So he's not foreseeing that the digital economy will outsource countries, jobs, and imagery so that whole populations are left homeless.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't see the disservices of the speed of effect. McLuhan sees those effects.
Right. Of course, the thing that I think of mostly when I think of McLuhan is his emphasis on the effects of the discarnate body. And I don't know if Thompson addresses that or is even concerned about it.
Yeah. Now, he does later. When I just said Thompson doesn't deal with the digital disservices, he does that in the 90s when they're obvious. But we're dealing with early Thompson here.
Mm-hmm.
At this phase. And unfortunately, I put this book together in 92. What Thompson, the change, well, the new things that Thompson realizes and presents in his writing happened in the middle 90s, came out of the seminar that I participated in at the Cathedral St. John of Divine, and Wired magazine came out, and the dot-com economic utopia and all that stuff. That was written a lot and developed and ideologized by friends of Thompson from the 60s, like Stuart Brand.
Mm-hmm.
Howard Rheingold, and many others. But Thompson was not, so he had to catch up to what they were doing, and then he adopted a critical stance in relation to that by the late 90s. But I don't have any quotes from that period in my book. Mm-hmm. You have to go to Five Body to get those quotes, or when we post them in our chat forums and that. All right.
Okay.
So we're going to go on to we have the 70s vision of Thompson. Now we're going to go into the particulars of spiritual transformation. And Thompson gives us the history of yoga. He's got into yoga when he was 15 in the L.A. counterculture. He becomes a meditator and explores the New Age culture in the 70s, and he sums it up in this book, which is indexed as TF at the end of the quote. And TF is the book, refers to the book, The Time Falling Bodies Take the Light. Subtitle, Mythology, Sexuality, and the Origins of Culture. And this was put out in New York by St. Martin's Press in 1981. This book is one of Thompson's most well-known books, and he is a very popular book. And the Evergreen said it was a great book. And so this is him applying his yogic knowledge to a mediated world, at least as he saw the mediated world in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And how are we going to deal with the collapse of mass institutions, in the what people call back then the military-industrial complex, the collapse of that, how do we re-stabilize ourselves? And he thinks yoga or meditation or something along those lines is the way to go. So this quote, which comes from The Time Falling Bodies Take the Light, comes from pages 18, 19, and 20, is a really good summation of that New Age meme, or its tradition that it comes from, yoga. And it's a long quote, so we hope Scott gets through it.
Did you say this was 1981?
Yes, yeah, so he wrote this in the late 70s. It comes out in 1981.
Okay. When God created the world, he divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. The human body is a recapitulation of this principle of order. For the body itself is the firmament which divides the waters of the brain from the waters of the genitals. Because of the sacred numinosity of the waters, all the fluids of the human body, saliva, sweat, semen, and blood, are sacred and mysterious substances. If Onians, O-N-I-A-N-S, has dug up an ancient image of the body in which the head and genitals intercommunicate through the spinal column, we do not have to wonder what such a system of meaning could have been like, for that ancient physiology still survives in Tantra yoga. In tantric practice, the yogi silently intones a special mantra while he focuses his attention upon his, quote, third eye. After several years of this practice, the yogi reaches a state in meditation where the vibration in his brain reverberates, in parentheses. Note the literal meaning of this as a vibrating word. Reverberates in his spinal column and begins to stimulate a sympathetic resonance at the base of his spine. The spinal column then begins to feel like a rod in which there are two strong magnetic poles at the extreme ends. As the vibration at the base of the spine responds to the vibration intoned with the mantra in the brain, the genitals become flooded with another feeling of vibration. The penis becomes erect, and the vibration within the brain becomes light, intensely energetic, and ecstatic. In Tantra, the fall into the body is reversed, and human consciousness is able to escape its entrapment in matter. In the religious traditions of Tantra, quote, loss of semen is loss of soul, and the yogi is counseled to keep himself free of women so that the seminal flow may reverse itself and move up into the brain in the awakening of Kundalini. In the ancient Jewish tradition, the seminal flow of men was also emphasized. In other stories of the Midrashim, Adam, in penance for his fall, abstains from sexuality for 130 years, but he is not able to control his nocturnal emissions. in his dream state, female spirits, the succubi, come and have intercourse with him. And with Adam's seed, they give birth to demons. The succubus lying on top of the man in his sleep and stealing his semen away is, of course, another image of Lilith, the female who refuses to stay in her, quote, proper place.
The female being who refuses to stay in her, quote, proper place.
Mm-hmm. The physiology of Tantra Yoga focuses on the magical numinosity of the male semen. But the experience of the awakening of Kundalini is not an exclusively male phenomena. With women, however, it is the menstrual blood which is seen as the sacred carrier of power, and it is the womb which is its sacred vessel. The spinal polarity in women is not between the genitals and the brain, but between the heart and the womb. The intense religious practices of yoginis, or nuns, the menstrual period can stop altogether. With the energy, or prana...
Wind,
the energy, or prana, associated with the lunar menstruation is stopped, time stops, and the woman is taken up into eternity. She gives birth to herself. By withdrawing into celibacy, the woman no longer generates karma, in parentheses, relatedness and relatives in time. Instead, she gives birth to the divine child. At this stage, the nun may have visions of the baby Jesus nursing at her own breast. Now, whereas the experience of the awakening of Kundalini in man floods the genitals and causes spontaneous erection and meditation, the equivalent experience in the woman causes an ecstatic rapture that can be described as, quote, an orgasm in the heart, or, quote, giving birth in the heart. The sudden opening of the heart chakra causes an ecstatic experience of illumination. The heart of the woman becomes at the heart of the universe. The Sufi image of this experience is the winged heart. It is for good reason that the sculptor Bernini pictured Saint Teresa in ecstasy as a woman in orgasm with an angel opening her heart with an arrow. In the etheric body of a yogini in meditation, the polarity is therefore not between the brain and genitals, the second and sixth chakras, but between the inner sexuality of the womb and the heart. Some Marxist feminists who have never practiced yoga become exercised at what they imagine is a sexist doctrine that locates man's consciousness in his brain but woman's consciousness in her heart. In fact, consciousness is not, as Whitehead would say, quote, simply located in the brain. The consciousness is suffused throughout the subtle bodies, and after a yogi has opened certain centers in the brain, he is counseled to center his being in the heart, not the head. That's the place where the yogi and yogini alike end up on the path of illumination, is the heart, to experience, quote, you're going to have to pronounce this, Bob.
L'amore che muove il sole e l'altra stella, which means the love that moves the sun and the other stars.
Yeah. That was pretty good. I didn't know you spoke, what is that, French?
No, it's, yeah. I think that is French.
Well, you did it well.
Yeah. Now, for a second, I thought it was Italian. No, it's French.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's my French background.
All right. Okay.
Though I don't get much chance to read and talk French. So the quote was, the love that moves the sun and other stars.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think of that?
Well, it's pretty powerful. I mean, it's probably the most well-crystallized vision of what these esoteric traditions are about that I've ever read.
Right, and what is unique is that he brings in the woman part of it, which is very rare. I've never seen anybody write about the yogini that way and explain their mystical version.
Yeah.
Mystical vision and the difference between male and female in the mystical transcendence. Most people think it's one doctrine, one experience, the same, but it's very creative what he came up with here. I don't know if other people, where he got this from, if he made it up or under the effect of feminists, men started to look at women a little more in the late 60s, early 70s, and he had to come up with something. He had all the 70s and all the feminist noise of the 70s to and books that these feminists were writing, he had to deal with that.
Yeah.
And so that's why his book was popular. I mean, I don't see McLuhan writing this kind of stuff. Definitely not LaRouche. And so he was a man who could communicate and include women, which was necessary once the feminist revolution, thanks to the global theater, happened.
Right.
Which was just the woman's chemical body getting autonomy like the male head.
Right. But he doesn't have a woman at his side like LaRouche has Helga, and you have Connie, and
well, Croker has his wife, and she's publicly a co-writer of his books and many of his articles. But Thompson, he was married to a woman, and they divorced in the late 60s, early 70s at some point, and she went on to live in Toronto. And then he hooked up with a woman and a teacher, you know, a kindergarten teacher, I think, in Switzerland. And, yes, he never didn't have a female partner in public. But he did embrace Lynn Margulies and female intellectuals. I mean, not personally, but he would write about female intellectuals. But you're right. He still represents, the monk, the isolated male monk, not engaging in earthly marriage,
mm-hmm.
and raising a family. He did have children with his first wife.
He's got kids.
Yeah, he had children with his first wife, but then he's a traveling scholar, wandering, what McLuhan called a gypsy scholar, and staying with this woman in Switzerland. But you don't hear about her. You're right, she's not part of his public image. So to that degree, his public image is about the esoteric tradition. He's representing the, in that sense, the male sensibility, even though his content is comprehensive.
Right.
So that's the paradox of Thompson. It's the best thing you ever read. He's talking about...
Now, this is interesting, this opening paragraph here, because McLuhan is talking about how technology extends and recapitulates the human form, but he opens up by saying, when God created the world, he divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. The human body is a recapitulation of this principle of order, for the body itself is the firmament which divides the waters of the brain from the waters of the genitals. So he's talking about how the body, the micro, reflects the macro in terms of the body reflects the cosmic, and then LaRouche is talking about how technology reflects the body. I mean, McLuhan talks about that.
Yeah, so Thompson is Platonic. He has the human body reflecting these archetypal forms, or invisible subtle forms, like the world of God creating the waters and the firmament. He has the human body in the interval, between the waters of the brain and the waters of the genitals. But he says a recapitulation of this principle. And so he's like LaRouche, dealing with abstract thought, but not secular thinking or human thinking, but an archetypal, subtle body, transhuman principle.
What is he talking about here? He's talking about the where the human body is a recapitulation for the body itself is firmament, which divides the waters of the brain from the waters of the genital. Now, he's not talking about meat here, you know. He's not talking about the chemical body. What is he talking about? The firmament, which
the
divides
astral body.
Waters of the brain, which is the astral body here, metaphor for the astral body, the brain or the genitals?
It's the subtle energies. Does he have the word subtle in the previous quote? I thought I saw that. Maybe not, but I think he has the word subtle in here. Didn't we say the word subtle? Anyway.
Well, I know I read, reading a little of his stuff, he associates the etheric body with the spine, and it's where it joins the brain. So the nerve, the neurons, and then he associates, the spinal column with the etheric body, the astral body with the limbic body, or that part of the brain in the middle. So the etheric body is the reptilian brain and the spinal cord, which drops down behind it. And then the astral plane is the limbic body, which is in the middle of the brain and controls nature, nurture, and mammalian kind of birthing processes and nurturing and like that. And then the mental body with, I guess, the cerebral cortex.
Right. So he is mapping the non-Western, Eastern, Indian, fourth world cultures and third world cultures' idea of chakras and subtle energies. He's mapping that into his idea of what our bodies are made up
right.
of.
And because LaRouche and McLuhan don't talk about this stuff, I am almost led to believe they think it's like irrelevant, which I don't see how it can be considered irrelevant.
Well, McLuhan writes about this in some of his essays in the early 50s, and he poses against the yogic vision. He mentions Zen and yoga. He sees these as forms of Manichaeanism or Gnosticism and not within the amazing metaphysical insight that was articulated by Thomas Aquinas of the, it's called the doctrine of proportionality of ratios among ratios. And why
is that not Gnostic? Because
it's involved with the world and not believing that there's a transcendent point beyond the world. So it's not interested in communicating with subtle energies.
Yeah, so that's sort of like that eliminates the bridge between the so-called spirit and matter.
Right, and well, that very split, therefore needed bridge between spirit and matter, McLuhan says, is the Gnostic vision. He thinks matter is spirit.
McLuhan does.
Yes. He wouldn't make it a dialectic. He just says it's a tactile interplay of living, sun-dappled energy.
So McLuhan doesn't...
Wind-dappled.
McLuhan doesn't think that God exists anywhere else than he does right here. And if the physical dimension, the world that we experience in 3D as a chemical physical world is as much of part of the God as anything else, and you can't draw distinctions between spirit and matter.
Right. He would say that God is neither in this world or the other world. God is in the interval. God is a mystery.
Oh, okay.
And the juggling, so that he says looking at whatever you see in this world is a metaphor for supposedly the other world, and the other world is a metaphor for this world. So the interplay, and that's the idea of a proportionality in perception, from one figure ground flipping into another figure ground.
Oh.
So it's complex. I don't know if we want to... I thought we may have covered that at some point.
Not in detail, because we never really went into this too deeply, because I don't know how, in what sense the other world has ratios that could relate to the ratios of the sensory world that we live in, unless it has its own sensory complements or something like that. But I guess I don't really understand the whole Thomas Aquinas thing too much. Although I do relate quite nicely to the idea of the ratio of proportion among the senses within the physical world. I don't know in what sense that relates to a ratio in the, quote, other world.
Well, I have the quote here where McLuhan's one of his best attempts to explain this doctrine of the, it's called the analogy of proper proportionality. And I guess it's considered the Thomas doctrine. Though McLuhan criticized Thomas, they didn't understand their own doctrine. All right, so this is spelled out in the book Through the Vanishing Point, which came out in 1968, and it's on page 240 of that book. McLuhan says, "Perhaps the most precious possession of man is his abiding awareness of the analogy of proper proportionality, the key to all metaphysical insight, and perhaps the very condition of consciousness itself." So he's saying this is the key to the condition of consciousness. "This analogical awareness is constituted of a perpetual play of ratios among ratios." I'll read that again. "This analogical awareness is constituted of a perpetual play of ratios among ratios. A is to B what C is to D, which is to say that the ratio between A and B is proportioned to the ratio between C and D, there being a ratio between these ratios as well. This lively awareness of the most exquisite delicacy So he's saying this is an exquisite perception. This lively awareness of the most exquisite delicacy depends upon there being no connection whatever between the components. If A were linked to B or C to D, mere logic would take the place of analogical perception. Thus, one of the penalties paid for literacy and a high visual culture is a strong tendency to encounter all things through a rigorous storyline, as it were. Paradoxically, connected spaces and situations exclude participation, whereas discontinuity affords room for involvement. Visual space is connected and creates detachment or non-involvement. It also tends to exclude the participation of the other senses. So the very end where it says visual space is connected and creates detachment or non-involvement, that is partly the Gnostic detachment from a world that seems to be Maya or the creation of the devil. You see what I'm saying? So
yeah.
Whereas the participation in this world approximates what he's trying to say here.
Well, I don't think the idea of Maya came out of literate visual space.
Oh, yeah. That's a product of writing.
That goes back to the Vedic times. I mean,
Well, Vedic, you're citing writing. It comes out of writing, not alphabetic writing, but writing.
Oh.
Yoga comes out of writing. Before yoga, Thompson may disagree, but Terence McKenna would say you had mysticism through plants. Eating plants, and that would be a more participatory form, not looking for some abstract condition of detachment or enlightenment. It's just enjoying the interplay of a speeded-up sensory life. Or a slowed
down. Idea that this world...
Or a slowed-down sensory life.
You think the idea that this world is a phenomenological illusion in the sense of Maya originates with visual space?
Yes, that's the point, McClellan's point. Writing brings it in. Before that, people thought the stars were in their eyes. They didn't have to have a split between the subject and the observed world. They participated the world.
Yeah.
Simple.
But shamans may have gone into ecstatic trance where they sort of transcended, went into visionary realms that didn't seem to relate to the physical world and therefore considered the physical world to be, you know, dematerialized as an illusion or something when they were in these, you know, astral or lucid dreaming states or whatever.
Well, some say that was a result of taking plant drugs. And they are known, or at least the cliche is, they had a great reverence for nature. So even though they went into another kind of sensory participation, it didn't devalue the world when they came down.
Yeah, it's true.
So it was, you could say they were exploring the proprioceptive senses,
mm-hmm.
the inner traveling senses. Certainly, our consciousness that we project back on to what they were doing is not the same consciousness that was the consciousness back then that took the plants.
Yeah.
That's Julian James's thesis, that before writing, people had a strange consciousness we can't experience. We can't project an idea of what it was.
Well, he thought that people were split, that the left and right hemispheres, that there was no corpus callosum communicating between the left and right hemispheres of the brain, that they were talking to each other like split individuals, like schizophrenic beings.
Yes, and McClellan would say that thanks to writing, we tend to made it possible to hoik up the left hemisphere, which then allowed a
hemisync.
Yeah, hemisync, and allowed a potential for synchronization, splitting and synchronization. They became the communication between two hemispheres became concretized through writing, then leading to the electric gates where we could drop the concretization but with awareness of its meme and retrieve the primitive awareness of interhemispherical confusion, which today is called being an abductee.
Mm-hmm.
And the tactile media, which enhance the interplay, means that we're enhancing the corpus callosum, which then that enhances the dialogue between the hemispheres. So primitive man was lost in an unconcretized, non-left hemisphere environment. Then it became extremely developed in the left hemisphere in the writing phase, what McLuhan calls the visual culture, and then flipped out of that into the dialogic of the hemispheres, which is what we have today.
Right.
And that allowed women to enter the dialogue, they being seen as a suppressed right hemisphere, unconscious suppression of the right hemisphere in a left hemisphere dominant writing, print, visual culture, which was patriarchal.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, there's an attempt to remind you of what McLuhan, how he defined this analogy of proper proportionality. So it's something to meditate on. You know, it's don't, and I'm not pretending or anybody listening to this is understanding it immediately, but it's interesting that he was aware of the occult and the esoteric traditions, but felt that there was something else to know beside the traditional idea of enlightenment.
Yeah. No, one of the things I'm most attracted to McLuhan with respect to his spiritual beliefs is this idea that the Gnostic split is the root of the problem and there actually is no split.
Yeah.
I think that is the root of tantric, well, the Buddhist doctrine as well, that that it's the split that gives rise to the sort of schizophrenic man who interprets everything in terms of self and other and feels isolated in his own sense of self.
Yeah, and that's due to writing. I mean, McLuhan documents the histories of the fragmented individual that writing and then especially the phonetic alphabet and then the printing press brings in.
Uh-huh.
So you'll hear among the New Agers, the ones who are into the dialectic of enlightenment, dialectic, two things, they will blame Descartes for creating the concept of the duality of perception or dualism. That's a big bugaboo in the New Age culture.
Right, and the universe is like a great, you know, the clockmaker, like a big watch, mechanical watch or something.
Right. Now, the New Agers don't realize that that's a sensory and mental effect of the printing press. And that Descartes, that was a novelty, that was something new. People didn't have the chance to experience the print effect before print, of course.
Yeah.
They didn't. It was a novelty to experience the dualism between mind and body that the book exaggerated.
Recently, I read Thompson says that Descartes had a mystical side, and that he would go back and forth from his sort of mystical Kabbalistic thinking into his modern scientific. What was modern at the time? Scientific.
Well, that's because Thompson. Grew and incorporated McLuhan and didn't get trapped in the New Age meme. And he dances on the toes of the New Agers who complain about this dualism. He's a little more sophisticated about it. Now, here's where you get the doctrine of proportionality among media. So, once you realize that dualism was intensified by the print effect, and Descartes was the thinker who surfboarded on that effect, and then you see the electric age reacquaints us to the holistic view and sees dualism as a negative factor of Western man, when you realize that our holism is retrieved by, as a conceptual idea, is retrieved by the electric environment, and then you move into the ratios among ratios and you realize that you can be dualistic when you read and enjoy the print effect. You can be holistic when you're in an electronic environment. And that's McLuhan's yoga. You adopt the ratios and figure ground effects of different historical technological memes or environments, and you don't become judgmental and favoring one modality like the New Agers favor the holistic, which is just a product of the global theater of satellite TV and computer. They don't know how to move in any cultural phase or cultural extension through history, which is what McLuhan said James Joyce could do and expressed in Finnegan's Wake. So when you know the figure ground, that's like A is to B, is C is to D.
Yeah.
A, the dualism is to holism when print is to electricity. You know what I mean? You start bringing media ratios.
Yeah.
And that kind of subtle awareness is what McLuhan's saying when he talks about the analogy of proper proportionality, so that you don't become a knee-jerk person.
You're a POB,
if you're a print-oriented bastard, you celebrate Descartesian dualism, unaware of its media cause, which is the printing press, and put down the new holisms, the new right hemisphere fanatics. So you have this argument between the left hemisphere stick-in-the-muds and the new right hemisphere global embracers or tree huggers, right?
Right.
Neither of them are recognizing the sensuous technological grounds of that. That's McLuhan's advantage. LaRouche would say all these categories are silly. Let's just get to work and make some new power sources.
You got a laboratory right next door to a cathedral, and you're quite comfortable moving in from the cathedral to relax and move into the laboratory to do some investigation, and you don't say one's better than the other.
Yeah, you don't. You do talk about the sensory biases each environment implements in you.
Yeah, but from the detached point of view of the imagination, which doesn't isn't identified with either space.
Right, but it's not a frozen detachment. It's a tactile interplay, mm-hmm. which means you engage in this world and any other worlds that are possible, and you're in the interval.
Cool.
Now, who is in the lab in the cathedral? Are you talking about McLuhan?
No, I was just using that as a kind of a architectural metaphor for the visual space and
all
the
right, that's interesting you bring that up. That's Thompson's vision. He tries to be tactile between the lab and the church, or the lab and the temple, or the lab and the monk's retreat. The point is that he's forgetting the TV landscape, which becomes later the TV body, or the chip landscape. So when you can't oscillate between the lab and the cathedral. That's a 19th century situation.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to interact with the news conference that's being held outside in the parking lot between the lab and the cathedral.
Mm-hmm.
At least McLuhan was aware of that. Thompson is juggling. That's why on the chart I have in the dyadic. He's juggling from the third position or the interval. He's juggling the left and the right, the lab and the religious. So it's still within that dualism. McLuhan is juggling from the tetrad position three things. He's juggling the lab, the church, and the television screen.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So then Croker is juggling from the pentadic position, the lab, the church, the TV screen, and how those three are just after images or memes inside technology come alive as a rampaging virus.
In the digital body?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Then Dobbs, from the hexadic position, juggles all of them. LaRouche, Croker, Thompson, and McLuhan. All from the perspective of the fusion of first and second nature through cold fusion or new subtle forms of medical technology.
Right.
So, do we want to read that quote again? Want me to read it? How much time do we have left?
Well, there's 10 minutes on the tape.
Yeah, I think I'd like to read this, even though you didn't. It's long.
Okay.
It's such a beautiful paragraph that we should reinstill it in the listeners' gonads and chakras, right?
Right.
So I'm going to try to read it. Hopefully I'll do it smoothly. And this is, again, page 18, 19, and 20 from Thompson's book, The Time Falling Bodies Take the Light. Published in 1981. So here we go. When God created the world, he divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. The human body is a recapitulation of this principle of order, for the body itself is the firmament which divides the waters of the brain from the waters of the genitals. Just want to say that the body itself is the firmament. It's in the gap, right?
Mm.
So the body is this tactile organism in between.
What does firmament mean?
Well, usually people, on a cliche level, mean heavens.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what it technically means. So it's like a landscape.
Right.
It's like an environment. Right?
Mm-hmm.
He says, when God created the world, he divided the waters which were under the environment, which were under the firmament. That would sound like the whole universe. The waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. So the firmament was the whole environment. Or something in between.
Yeah, I'm just looking it up on the dictionary here, and it says figurative, this is one of the meanings, figurative, a sphere or world viewed as a collection of people, or one of the great stars and the great American.
So it's a collection of an environment.
Yeah.
Okay, so he says, the human body is a recapitulation of this principle of order, for the body itself is the firmament, or environment, which divides the waters of the brain from the waters of the genitals. So it's a tactile version of an environment because it's inside and outside. It's container and contained.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the sacred numinosity of the waters. But he is setting up a dialectic here, a split, you know, between the genitals and the brain.
Mm-hmm.
So he set up a dyad. We could call it the dialectic of enlightenment. Because of the sacred numinosity of the waters, all the fluids of the human body, saliva, sweat, semen, and blood, are sacred and mysterious substances. So he's beginning to overcome a bit of this Gnostic split by not favoring one or the other. Because all the fluids are sacred.
Yeah, when he talks about man leaving tribal culture and beginning in Sumer, the Western civilization, he talks about the goddess, I think her name's Tiamat, and she actually represents the water, the salt, the waters of the oceans, the salt waters. And so this, in the waters are kind of, they originate as being sort of a feminine, the great mother, soup in which life begins.
Yeah, the firmament.
Mm-hmm.
The environment. So, if Onians, who must have been, I think he's an author that has written on some of this history, and Thompson's commenting on him. If Onians has dug up an ancient image of the body in which head and genitals intercommunicate through the spinal column, we do not have to wonder what such a system of meaning could have been like, for that ancient physiology still survives in Tantra yoga. I think he's talking about maybe an image in a caveman or something, some ancient image. And the guy is projecting a yogic kind of interpretation on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so Thompson's saying, well, if that's what Onian's doing, we see that in Tantra yoga. It's almost like Thompson is saying what Onians would not call yoga, Thompson is being gutsy and saying it is yoga. But no academic would have done that in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
In tantric, Western academic anyways, in tantric practice, the yogi silently intones a special mantrum while he focuses his attention upon his third eye. After several years of this practice, the yogi reaches a state in meditation where the vibration in his brain reverberates, note the literal meaning of this as a vibrating word, says Thompson, reverberates in his spinal column and begins to stimulate a sympathetic resonance at the base of his spine. The spinal column then begins to feel like a rod in which there are two strong magnetic poles at the extreme ends. As the vibration at the base of the spine responds to the vibration intoned within the mantrum, intoned with the mantrum in the brain, the genitals become flooded with another feeling of vibration, the penis becomes erect, and the vibration within the brain becomes light, intensely energetic, and ecstatic. In Tantra, the fall into the body, there's the Gnostic fall, the fall into the body is reversed and human consciousness is able to escape its entrapment in matter. In the religious traditions of Tantra, quote, loss of semen is loss of soul, and so the yogi is counseled to keep himself free of women so that the seminal flow may reverse itself to move up into the brain in the awakening of Kundalini. In the ancient Jewish tradition, the seminal flow of men was also emphasized. In other stories of the Midrashim, Adam, in penance for his fall, abstains from sexuality for 130 years, but he's not able to control his nocturnal emissions. In his dream state, female spirits, the succubi, come and have intercourse with him, and with Adam's seed, they give birth to demons. The succubus lying on top of the man in his sleep and stealing his semen away is, of course, another image of Lilith, the female being who refuses to stay in her, quote, proper place. The physiology of Tantra yoga focuses on the magical numinosity of the male semen, but the experience of the awakening of Kundalini is not an exclusively male phenomenon. With women, however, it is the menstrual blood which is seen as a sacred carrier of power, and it is the womb which is its sacred vessel. The spinal polarity in women is not between the genitals and the brain, but between the heart and the womb. In the intense religious practices of yoginis or nuns, the menstrual period can stop altogether. When the energy or prana associated with lunar menstruation is stopped, time stops and the woman is taken up into eternity. She gives birth to herself. By withdrawing into celibacy, the woman no longer generates karma, which is relatedness and relatives in time. Instead, she gives birth to the divine child. At this stage, the nun may have visions of the baby Jesus nursing at her own breast. Now, whereas the experience of the awakening of Kundalini in man floods the genitals and causes spontaneous erection and meditation, the equivalent experience in the woman causes an ecstatic rapture that can be described as, quote, an orgasm in the heart unquote, or giving birth in the heart. That's quote two, giving birth in the heart, unquote. The sudden opening of the heart chakra causes an ecstatic experience of illumination. The heart of the woman becomes the heart of the universe. The Sufi image of this experience is the winged heart. It is for good reason that the sculptor Bernini pictured St. Teresa in ecstasy as a woman in orgasm with an angel opening her heart with an arrow. In the etheric body of a yogini in meditation, the polarity is therefore not between the brain and the genitals, the second and sixth chakras, but between the inner sexuality of the womb and the heart. Some Marxist feminists who have never practiced yoga become exercised or irritated at what they imagine is a sexist doctrine that locates man's consciousness in his brain, but women's consciousness in her heart. In fact, consciousness is not, as Whitehead would say, quote, simply located in the brain, unquote. The consciousness is suffused throughout the subtle bodies. And there's the phrase, subtle bodies. The consciousness is suffused throughout the subtle bodies, and after a yogi has opened certain centers in the brain, he is counseled to center his being in the heart, not the head. He is counseled to center his being in the heart, not in the head. Thus, the place where yogi and yogini alike end up on the path of illumination is the heart. To experience, l'amor che muove il sole e l'altra stella, which means the love that moves the sun and other stars.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's Italian. That's not French.
Maybe.
Italian or Latin. Can't remember. Anyways, the love that moves the sun and other stars.
Yes.
So, did we get that on tape?
Probably there's a minute left, but this is a very, very different territory from what we've been exploring. We've been exploring politics and technology and electric and visual space. Now we're exploring this